Welcome to New Human Living Radio Show, bringing you powerful interviews to awaken the power in you. Learn more at newhumanliving.com. And now your host, Les Jensen.
So, what's the term blasphemy mean? Blasphemy. I know that's a term that maybe isn't used all the time, but if we look at it, a simple definition is maybe insulting a greater condition, insulting the truth, insulting whatever. If you take a step back and look what's happening in the collective, there's a real strong push. People are fighting for a singular narrative. There's a lot of pressure for everyone to get under a singular narrative. Let's all do this. Let's all do that. And from my perspective, I think that's blasphemy to nature. You know, when you're on social media and you click on something and all of a sudden you see more and more of it, maybe there's whatever topic shows up, and the more you click on it, the more it brings you more examples of that. Well, I suggest you do this. When you're on social media, look at pictures of the uniqueness of nature. Nature expressing itself in a unique way. Now, I've been doing this for at least a decade. And maybe it's a sea urchin with an orange crust and a fluorescent green head and little tentacles coming out the back. Or it's a bug that looks like a stick and you couldn't see it on a tree if you had to. Or it's and what I'm getting at is nature's been in its own rodeo now for like a billion years, or probably several billion years, and it seems like it's just beginning. It seems hilarious that nature's just beginning to express itself, because it perpetually creates a new perspective, a new dynamic. Blasphemy to nature is some kind of a template. The human dynamic is only normal in Humanville. The human template, the human genome, is only, quote, normal, unquote, in Humanville. You could take humans off the planet, and nature would do just fine for eternity. Nature knows what it's doing. In fact, our human ego is woefully ill-equipped to advise nature in any way, shape, or form. I'll give you an example. The reason I bring this up tonight is how our narratives are collapsing. And tonight, I'm very excited about tonight's episode. The topic tonight is the era of brilliant homeopathic mental hospitals. And our guest tonight is Jerry Cantor. We're going to bring Jerry on in just a minute. But I've worked in TV now over 40 years. And when you work in TV, when you're in a building that's putting out TV 24/7 for decades, you see some stuff over time. You see some stuff. There was a show that It was investigating exotic cures. It was a documentary about third world countries or villages in the Amazon, or in other words, it left the traditional Western narrative and it went looking for unique cures to problems. And there was one particular medicine man in this small village in the middle of flipping nowhere, and the locals would bring him all sorts of disease, all manner of disease. And there was one particular case where the journalist was interviewing all the patients as they were lining up to see the medicine man. And they came across a patient, and I'm sorry, but I don't remember the particular ailment. But the journalist said, "Oh, really? The Western world has no cure for that. We don't have a cure for that ailment. It was some kind of a psychological ailment." And so the journalist, every time this patient had come back, it would follow it. And what the medicine man did was take these big leaves from a plant and fold them in half lengthwise, and he'd put them up to the patient's forehead and all around the head, and then he'd wrap it with twine, and it looks like he's making a crown. But what he's making is a bowl using these leaves. And once he had enough leaves all the way around this person's head, he made up a cocktail of, it looked like syrup, and he poured it on the man's head. And I'm like, what is going on? I mean, so he'd pour this fluid on top of this man's head, and he'd let it sit there. And then the patient came back and did this a couple more times, and the person was cured. So where the hell is that? Where did that go? In that, if we look at our narrative today, if we look at the collective consciousness of humanity today, we're pigeonholing so many things that work just fine, and we're trying to substitute that with singular narratives. All right, enough about that. I want to get to the show because Jerry has written a wonderful book. The topic of the show tonight is actually the subtitle of the book. The book is called Sane Asylums, Sane Asylums, The Success of Homeopathy Before Psychiatry Lost Its Mind. You can see why I used that example in the just a moment ago. Let's get to it. Presenting the official homeopathic blueprint for treating mental disorders, Jerry explores Talat's methods, including nutrition and sophisticated side effect-free homeopathic prescriptions, and how Middletown inspired similarly enlightened sane asylums across the country. He reveals how homeopathy was pushed aside by pharmaceuticals. There's that single narrative, pharmaceuticals, which often caused more harm than good. I'll try to act surprised. As well as how the current critical attitude in the collective towards homeopathy has distorted the historical record. There's blasphemy when we're collapsing the many different ways that nature has to heal itself. It's blasphemy to pigeonhole the different ways we can accommodate what we seek. Jerry shows how we can improve the care and treatment of the mentally ill and stop the exponential growth of terminal mental disorder diagnostics that are rampant today. The mental strategy today is take a pill, take Xylene 12, and you won't feel a thing. I'm looking forward to this episode. Let's get to it. Join me in welcoming Jerry to the show. Jerry, it's nice to finally have you on the show.
Thank you very much, Les. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I like to make sure we use language effectively. And so can we start off with a concise description of what homeopathic medicine is all about?
Sure, that's a good place to start. So the word homeo, we can break it down. Homeo means same as, and apathy relates to sickness. Same to treat sickness. This is the law of similars in homeopathy, using like to cure like. So client comes into my office, doesn't matter what he or she has going on, but very likely going to be a hodgepodge of mental and emotional problems, maybe anxiety, depression, but also physical symptoms that could affect the digestion, metabolism, respiration, all kinds of things. And homeopaths are not specialists. We take the whole kit and caboodle of the person, and we have to find a remedy which connects all the dots for that person, and where the mental and the emotional features, the characteristics, and we can talk a lot about what that is. You know, those are the driving clue. So what is a remedy? A remedy is something very, very dilute. Hardly any of the material that is there. The material having been come from originally a plant or a mineral or chemical compound, could even be an existing medicine or the venom of a snake or an ant, that in a gross amount would cause that exact complex of symptoms, mental, emotional, and physical, that we see in the person. So someone's in my office, and I say to myself, it's as if this person was poisoned by a rattlesnake venom, or it's as if this person was, bitten by a cockroach or something like that. Because in homeopathy, sure, we have researched very extensively what that substance does on mental, emotional, and physical levels. So giving that same substance full strength would be a terrible idea, like pouring gasoline on a fire and expecting it to go out. But if you dilute it many, many, many times and energize it, and I have done my job properly and accurately, then the very concise prescription of that substance should fit like a glove. And when the person takes that remedy, that's what it's called, homeopathic remedy, it's like a permission slip to the subconscious. The subconscious is what homeopaths refer to as the vital force. It releases a reaction that actually wants to happen, but has not happened in that person. So it's from within. And a person gets better in consequence of that. A single accurate prescription, this is mind-blowing, even though it has hardly anything in it, can affect that person over several weeks, if not months, while they're working that issue out. And by the time they return to the office, if the prescription has been accurate, they are considerably better.
So you're taking a substance like rattlesnake venom or scorpion, whatever, that the effects of that would mimic the symptoms the patient's talking about, and then you take an extremely small amount of that and issue it as a dose of medicine. I'm trying to speak back to you what you just said. And so when you give the body the minute amount of what it, like snake poison, that would have the same effect as the patient is already reporting, that small effect affects the vital force, which you call the subconscious. Well, you relate to the subconscious, and that small amount permission slip. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I think of it as a permission slip to the subconscious. Yeah, the vital force is the subconscious with one additional feature, well, with a very significant additional feature. We usually think of the subconscious as being completely psychological. The vital force, which has all the features of the subconscious, but also physical attributes. In other words, there's no distinction between the mind and the body. If that particular substance causes, and by the way, I should say that what I was describing is homeopathic research, how we know that the substance causes that. We would get maybe 10 or 15 people, healthy people, not sick people, who agree to participate in homeopathic research called approving. And under blinded conditions, they're not told what they're taking. They keep their lives stable, and they take some kind of a substance that we want to understand. And they take it on a regular basis for maybe 3 or 4 months, and they keep journals about what they notice.
Right.
And at the end of that period of time, those journals are forwarded to the proving organizer, the researcher, and there's a big collation job done. We collate out the interesting symptoms that are consistent among those people. And that include mental, emotional, and physical features. And those end up in homeopathic textbooks called Materia Medica.
Okay.
So when homeopaths study, they have to get to know that Materia Medica very well, and they have to be able to analyze a patient's symptoms through what's called rubrics so that we can identify the correct remedy that's made from those substances. It's really common sense, deep common sense, once you get used to it. I liken it to the idea of getting back on the horse that threw you, a very, very simple comparison. Let's say a horse throws you, and you say, oh, my God, I'm never going to get on a horse again. That's a trauma to me. I'm done with that. That's the end of it. Well, the expression is, it's just an ordinary idiom, get back on that horse. Get back on the horse that threw you. Otherwise, the fear of horses will be permanently entrenched in you, right?
Oh, right.
Okay, well, maybe you shouldn't get on the same crazy horse that threw you, but something similar, like are we talking about the law of similars? Maybe a gentle horse or a pony. Okay, now you're up on that gentle horse, walking around, you think, oh my God, I'm back on a horse. This is terrible. This is awful. It's going to throw me again. You're re-engaging with the scene of the crime, with the trauma under more favorable circumstances. That's what a remedy does. And when you get off the horse, you're back to baseline or you're even better.
Very nice. I'm going to take a moment. I was remiss in introducing you. I need to read your credentials so the audience knows who's talking here. Jerry is a faculty member at the Ontario College of Homeopathic Medicine and owner of Vital Force Healthcare, a Boston area homeopathic and acupuncture practice. He is the first acupuncturist to receive an academic appointment at Harvard Medical School's Department of Anesthesiology. Jerry is the author of Interpreting Chronic Illness, The Toxic Relationship Cure. And you can learn more at Vital Force Healthcare and WriteWellPress.com. The book is Revealing the Astonished but Suppressed History of Homeopathic Psychiatry. Jerry examines the success of homeopathic psychiatric asylums in America. So successful psychiatric asylums in America from post-Civil War era till 1920, including how he focuses in particular on New York's Middletown State Homeopathic Hospital for the Insane, where Superintendent Talcott oversaw a compassionate and holistic treatment regimen that married Thomas Kirkbride's moral treatment principles to homeopathy. I wanted the audience to know your background, and it was my remiss. I apologize for not doing that before I brought you on the show, but I need to validate your credentials so people know who's talking. So let's get back to it. So this is fascinating. So homeopathic medicine is creating a database of the effects of particular substances, and then you're using that database that's built by people who volunteer to take a substance over a period of time and then document the effects on the persona, and then you turn around and use that as a medicine. Now let's fold this into, let's look at the past, as the book talks about, when homeopathic techniques were successful in insane asylum treatments of patients. Tell us about the heyday or the successful era in our history.
Wow. That is that's the entire book. Well, homeopathy has had a real presence since the late 1700s when Samuel Hahnemann came on the scene. He was a very famous physician and brilliant man, famous all throughout Europe. And by the way, he's the only not foreigner to have a statue of himself in Washington, D.C. You should go see the Samuel Hahnemann memorial statue. It's amazing. He was hugely respected. And homeopathy took hold because it was a fantastic medicine and didn't cause side effects. It didn't harm the clients. And we just get these amazing cures when we can prescribe accurately. After the Civil War caused so much carnage and so much trauma in this country that the country pretty much went crazy. They couldn't get the bodies of their lost sons and husbands. They're blown to bits. They couldn't wait to hear like wonderful last words of people. They couldn't retrieve the bodies and hope for a resurrection. So the country was in deep grief and really went crazy. And what I'm explaining is why so many mental hospitals cropped up after the Civil War. It was just amazing. And homeopathic hospitals were a large percentage of them. That story has been disgracefully suppressed, censored. It does not. It has been scrubbed cleanly from the websites of the medical medical schools that were originally homeopathic, from the hospitals, the hundreds of hospitals that were originally homeopathic, just wiped out, and that's a disgrace, and that's something that that story alone needs to be told. Anyway, but these asylums that I call sane asylums, they were called insane asylums, but in fact, the homeopathic ones were really very wonderful places. They were utopias. They were self-sufficient. They had all kinds of wonderful activities there. The Middletown Hospital even used baseball therapeutically, developing a fantastic team that people love watching. And there's so many therapeutic things about baseball. But in any case, they were treated with respect, which is the regime of moral care. And to be fair, non-homeopathic hospitals did that too until they realized that they couldn't control these clients, and like at Utica, put them in infamous devices like the Utica crib to punish you and to break your spirit. That never happened in the homeopathic hospitals. In the homeopathic hospitals, the physicians went around giving these remedies to people while they respected them and allowed them to participate in letter writing and carpentry and gardening and all kinds of wonderful things. They were not kicked out of those places and pushed into the community prematurely. They were given asylum and allowed to be cured. They also had fantastic nursing. The Middletown Hospital had a genius homeopathic physician, a woman who was a nurse educator, who wrote a great book called Nursing the Insane in 1908. This is Clara Barris, and she wrote probably the best holistic nursing manual ever done. And anyway, people went, these nurses and the doctors went to bat with the insane population, trying through argument and persuasion and peace and quiet and homeopathy to get them to come back to reality. It was not a matter of warehousing them and drugging them at all. They really went to bat for it. That one of the terms for that would be moral hygiene. There's so much to say about it. It's quite amazing. But they were wonderful. They were utopias. Utopianism was a big deal at that time anyway, and that infected these homeopathic hospitals. But the problem was the demise of that, which has been completely distorted by history, was that they failed, not because homeopathy failed, not at all, It was because that they were crammed full of clients. They had like five times the number of people there that they should have had, and the level of care broke down, and then the pharmaceutical agenda was pushed on them, and the regular physicians came back, and moral care itself was destroyed, and all the old abuses from the 1700s, from like in places in Bedlam, incarcerating clients, putting them in shackles, and hydrotherapy, and then eventually lobotomies. All that terrible stuff came back, and in very cynical fashion, an impression has been left that homeopathy was part of that. That is absolutely not true, and it is my mission to correct that fallacy.
Well, your book is quite exceptional because you've really been over backwards to bring references to everything that you talk about. There's so much content in this book, and it's quite obvious you've been over backwards to validate and back up everything that you've referenced in this book. I just want to compliment you on such a intense and in-depth task. I think you've done a wonderful job. So, well, it's so easy all you have to do is turn on the TV and wait 10 seconds, and there's some commercial telling you about Prizine 12, and it'll remove the issue you have, but the side effects might include horrible, horrible things. And if that's our narrative, if that's making the airwaves and homeopathic success and effect is not, that's that blasphemy I'm talking about. It's like we're getting pushed into this single narrative about our healthcare, like Western medicine in the pharmaceutical arena is some kind of a godsend, and it's just, I don't see it. I mean, what I really like about the homeopathic method is you're using a very subtle amount to trigger the body, and then the body does the reaction and restoration to health. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. As you know, it's like a psychopharm medicine. Just suppresses your symptoms and replaces some of them with other symptoms, sometimes, you know, sometimes worse. But the thing about it is those medicines enjoy patents and they make money, and the business of America is America, and medicine is based on the profit motive. We lost an opportunity in the demise of the homeopathic school. It never went away, by the way. It's still here, but a lot more undercover than it used to be. Homeopathic remedies don't belong to anybody any more than acupuncture points belong to anybody. And this is fantastic medicine. It's just about getting people well and from the inside out and not making money. But as you know, the profit motive, the greed of that, it's been fantastic, really very, very good for the economy. So many people are employed in the production of drugs and testing of drugs and marketing of drugs, and I mean, it's a tremendous economic engine that homeopathy and acupuncture, simply don't. But for my money, you really can't improve on the knowledge of 5,000-year-old Chinese medicine, which includes acupuncture, almost equally long, well, not quite as long, history of homeopathy, which is also runs according to a law of nature, like using like to cure like. There's no comparison. And, the denial of homeopathy as being powerful, being a law of nature, it's one of the great denials of our century, up there with climate change denial, I'm ashamed to say.
Well, the way this affects the subconscious, I mean, if I like the analogy that you used, that if you get on the horse and the horse bucks you off and you take on a fear, your persona, your psyche takes on a fear or a memory of the experience that creates a posturing in your psyche. And that is the beginning of a perhaps a dis-ease. And then to come along and heal that imprint on your psyche with a like-minded experience, and then the subconscious, or as you say, the vital force, heals its own stigma. That I just find that fascinating.
You know, Les, if you would allow me, I would like, towards the end of my book, I have a case. I have a few cases in the book from my own caseload. And it just makes so many points that I'd like to read it. I don't think the audience will be bored if I do this. But it's a very good example of a number of things we're talking about. Is that okay?
You betcha.
Okay. This is called The Case of the Naked Schoolgirl. So on a daily basis, the mother of my patient, who is a nine-year-old girl, let's call her Miranda, so the mother receives a frantic call from the school. During transition from one activity to another, the child has once again removed every stitch of her clothes. In her naked state, it's forbidden to touch her, and classroom activity has screeched to a halt. Neither teacher nor staff member can persuade her to dress. If this continues, Miranda will have to be removed from this and placed in an inappropriate, possibly psychiatric setting. A stressful implication hangs in the air that the child has been subjected to sexual abuse, possibly within the family. The mother is beside herself. The child's behavior was abnormal. Was she abused? Must we assume that Miranda has a psychiatric disorder? Does she require medication? According to the Encyclopedia of Mental Disorders, exhibitionism is a mental disorder characterized by compulsion to display one's genitals to an unsuspecting stranger. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders classifies exhibitionism under the heading of paraphilias, which is a subcategory of sexual and gendered identity disorders. I'll skip what that part is. Okay, so the product, going back to her, the product of a family passionately committed to her development, Miranda is a remarkably intelligent child who has Down syndrome. And that's a genetic disorder, as we know, caused by abnormal cell division. She's able to speak three languages, loves gymnastics, singing, dancing, swimming, playing the piano, cooking, baking, going to the beach, reading, eating cupcakes, ice cream, hugging, and anything yellow. Miranda had been referred to me a year earlier due to an unresponsive immune system. She had been chronically ill, unable to remain healthy for more than a few days at a time. She was constantly on antibiotics. Miranda never slept through the night. A finding of elevated levels of ferritin and vitamin B12 were associated with her poor sleep. She underwent evaluation by a neurologist at a major Boston teaching hospital for PANS, which is pediatric acute onset neuropsychiatric disorders associated with streptococcus, quite a mouthful, with tests for Cunningham panel, metabolic tests, and all measurement levels of antibodies were found high, including dopamine 1 receptor, dopamine 2L receptor, high GAN glyoside GM1, and tubulin. Autoimmune antibodies binding to these targets were hypothesized as interfering with antigen function. Sorry that got so technical. Okay.
No worries.
So over the course of 3 months, where I had used just a handful of remedies, Miranda's physical health continuously improved. In fact, she ceased becoming ill. The aim of continued treatment then veered into helping her manage everyday frustrations and sustain mental focus. A consult at the time of the phone calls brought to light that apart from disrobing the disrobing in school problem, Miranda's impulse control, especially with regard to her clamoring for sweets, had greatly improved. Now, even within homeopathy, interpreting Miranda's disrobing provided a challenge. The chief remedy within rubrics such as desires to be naked or exhibitionism, that usually brings up this remedy called hyoscyamus. But I knew that nothing about that remedy fit her. If that remedy were prescribed, it would not act. And the remedy I wound up choosing did not surface among any of the 399 entries that populated my computer Materia Medica when I put in nakedness. It was just simply not there. So this required a little bit of out-of-the-box thinking, even for a homeopath. So key for me was the consul's revelation that Miranda loved to collect. Now we're getting into the kind of things that are so specific, the kind of specific, unique features about someone that homeopaths love. Also in response to her prior remedy, which was something called lycopodium, the theme in that remedy was insecurity. And you wouldn't be surprised to think that somebody who has a problem like or a state like Down syndrome might, for all kinds of reasons, become insecure. In any case, on that remedy, her psyche, her vital force, underwent what I call a pendulum swing. As opposed to being generally uncertain, she had shifted into a state characterized by certitude. This was evident from her suddenly becoming oppositional and defiant to the point of driving her mother to distraction. Now, the collector's supposition is that alike items should be conserved, and so Miranda's proclivity for collecting supported my assessment. She had other symptoms, too. These included throat clearing and being gassy. I had no doubt that Miranda needed this remedy that I finally came up with called calicarbonicum, which is made from potassium carbonate. Now, people needing – now we're going to get into what the materia medica about calicarbonicum is all about. People needing this remedy have a black and white mindset. They're judgmental. They're intolerant of change. And not surprisingly, traditionalists. What stresses them out is gray areas, transitional situations. She's the kind of person who thinks, here's the polarity in at the core of this of the calicarbonicum state. My need for certitude and control is so great that upon attaining surety and control, matters about which I cannot be sure are uncontrollably uncertain. So that's the polarity of the state. Well, still, I struggled with how disrobing fit into the calicarbonicum picture. As I said, it doesn't nakedness, disrobing does not come up anywhere in the materia medica. But then I suddenly realized that there was no contradiction. In Miranda's individual case, she disrobed in opposition to what to her was an intolerable transition. Her nakedness made several calicarbonicum points. And these are this. This is what they are. I know who I am and you do not. Nothing has changed since I was born. In my birthday suit, this is who I am and always have been. My current activity ought not to change. So brilliantly, her nakedness stymied anyone touching or transitioning her. It was amazing. Well, so I was convinced that this was not a cry for help, that she was not abused. Her exhibitionism actually served a conservative purpose. And I predicted that the remedy would eliminate the behavior. And I'm pleased to say that within 2 days of taking the remedy, that behavior completely stopped, and she completely stopped taking off her clothes. So that's a case I brought that illustrates how a remedy can treat a problem which has, physical characteristics, psychological characteristics, and absolutely resists categorization on many, many levels. Can you imagine the good that did in comparison to what could have happened to that girl if she was taken away from her family, if she was medicated once again, if she was given a psychiatric diagnosis, if she was taken out of school? That simple intervention that followed normal homeopathic thinking on my part, that was a very, very good outcome.
Indeed. I mean, to turn around and try to sedate that with a lifetime of medication and I mean, what's better than nature healing itself? I mean, you're basically providing these extremely subtle triggers for the subconscious to right itself, and it's not overpowering, and there's not a list of side effects, and it's this has been really fascinating. So imagine a listener that where they themselves or perhaps a family member has ailments that have been treated with strong medicines. How do you go about engaging the homeopathic community? If is there a national directory so you can find local people?
Yeah, we exist now. As opposed to acupuncture, it's not licensed in every state, and some states actually have it. Some states, I believe, you have to be a physician to practice it. It's a very messy situation, but we have credentialing. The gold standard for credentialing a homeopath comes from an organization called the CAC, the Council for Homeopathic Certification. And to get that certification, you got to go to a school. You got to present a number of cases. You have to pass an exam. That's the gold standard. There's a silver standard too, which is also very high, through the North American Society of Homeopaths. But in any case, yeah, there are registries. If you, I would suggest people go to the CAC website to find a homeopath. That we have them in every state. But the funny thing about homeopathy is it's fragmented in this country, such that chiropractors there are chiropractor homeopaths, there are naturopath homeopaths, there are veterinary homeopaths, and there's still an association of physicians who are homeopaths, the AIH. It's just a kind of fragmented landscape. But all of us who practice the classical method use these materia medicas, which have all the information about the remedies, and the other book, which is the repertory, which breaks every symptom a human being can have, or an animal, into these rubrics that represent mental, emotional, and physical features. I refer to them in that case there. As I say, in the mind section of a repertory, if you were trying to find a remedy for Miranda, you would undoubtedly look up disrobing or nakedness, and this remedy hyoscyamus would constantly come up, and a few other ones. But I guarantee using that remedy for her would simply not have worked. So there's a subtlety to homeopathy, and people become better at being subtle practitioners with experience. So, yeah, we're not a huge part of the population in this country, but other parts of the world, if you're lucky to leave the shores of America, if you went to Switzerland, you would find it's absolutely embedded in the healthcare system. In London, in England, even though it's been under attack quite ferociously over the past few years, still part of the National Health Service. I have the statistics someplace, but at least 300 million people rely on it. In India especially, there are hundreds of homeopathic medical schools, hundreds. And physicians come out of there practicing exclusively homeopathy. Once you get away from the propaganda in this country, medicine can look quite different. As in the example that you gave, Les, traditional means are very powerful, and they're constantly being rediscovered and putting our so-called high technology medicine to shame. As a matter of fact, if you read the books by Robert Whittaker, who was an inspiration for my book, modern psychiatry has given America a terrible mental health record, much worse than developing countries where they're not exposed to these things. It's really really quite a shame.
Well, so assume I'm a mental health practitioner, professional, and I'm increasingly less and less impressed with the side effects of perhaps some of the medications on the market, and I've listened to this episode, and I like the idea of nature healing nature. How could somebody who's been practicing psychiatry, how much effort would it take to be certified in a homeopathic skill set?
It would just take a will to learn it, but I think you would probably be burning bridges with most of your colleagues. A few of my friends, my colleagues are psychiatrists. Eric Leskowitz, who wrote this amazing foreword to my book, is a homeopathic psychiatrist. He completely gets it. He totally gets it. I have other colleagues who have tried to travel a middle road, rely on their conventional medicines if they're running into a difficult case, but trying to be homeopaths. It is very, very difficult to do both things at once. Basically, you have to jump into the river with both feet and learn how to swim there. Pretty much anybody who really gets the homeopathic message cannot serve two masters. It's almost impossible. And I think every time, and there's been many, many attempts to appropriate homeopathy, to tame it, to make it, make some kind of a marriage between the two forms of medicine. They don't go well for homeopathy. They never do. Diluting it, no pun intended, is just not a good idea. Once you get into it and you realize that, there's just no compromise with it. You really have to have a lot of faith in that way of working. And then you will wind up becoming primarily a homeopath. The early homeopaths, by the way, ones I write about in my book and even before that, they weren't homeopaths from high school. They were physicians who converted. And that's long been the story. So what you're talking about happens all the time. Doctors do get disgusted with what happens. They do get disgusted with the profit motive. And many of them do drop out. It's a trope. It's happened many, many times. Many homeopaths were originally physicians.
Yeah, there's real blasphemy, and that's why I started this episode off with that term, with the idea of one modality strong-arming its way as a singular narrative for the whole. In other words, for Western medicine to become our only choice is blasphemy to the nature of nature. Nature has 100 million ways to do anything. I mean, we could have, we've had many shows over the years of people using non-traditional methods as a way to restore health, either within their persona or within their practice. So I'm delighted that, again, you've written a really wonderful book. It's so comprehensive, and it's backed up by so many references. It took you quite a while to write this, didn't it?
I like to joke that that's how I spent my COVID vacation. I just worked like a madman, and my poor wife was ignored for quite a bit of this time, as she will tell you. I had a full-time practice while I did it, but I had fantastic resources. I got hold of all these old textbooks, thanks to the University of Michigan's digitalization process. I had a lot just sort of came my way. I also want to leave the audience with my recounting of a 150-year-old journalistic coup in regard to Mary Todd Lincoln that I did not know I was going to stumble on. And this is also emblematic of how powerful censorship could go. I mean, I'm not trying to teach homeopathy so much in this book. I mean, though I'm very glad that happens, as to show the bad consequences, the consequences that come from censorship, from pretending something that happened didn't happen and distorting history. Now, there's been hundreds and hundreds of books written about Mary Todd Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's widow, who went completely out of her mind. She had a serious head injury. She was trolled by a terrible writer at the time who said that Lincoln never loved her, that he loved someone else originally and much more than her. And, of course, the loss of two sons and then becoming a widow. She was also a pariah in Washington, D.C., because she was from the South and her family had slaves. She was hated, and she had every justification for losing her mind. She surely did. But the two narratives that exist about that, they're both completely implausible. I mean, this enormous enormous trial took place. 14 doctors testified that she had lost her mind. Her son brought the case. He was trying to save her and get her some help. She was certifiably nuts. She was hallucinating. She was doing all kinds of nutty things. And anyway, the physician, they found her incurably insane, and she was told she had to go to a mental hospital. Now, the physicians there include, and many of them were homeopaths at the trial, they said, go see this guy Richard Patterson in Bellevue. He's got a Bellevue, Illinois. He's got a wonderful little asylum there, and he's a master at treating the mentally ill. He can do this. Okay, so she went there and was treated by Richard Patterson, and in 3 months, over the course of 4 months, she's behaving normally. She's writing letters. She's sitting, chatting with Patterson's wife and child. She's absolutely normal. And then she gets hold of these two lawyers who get her out. And then a few months later, she's declared perfectly sane. So there's the other narrative. Well, she was never crazy in the first place. She's either completely nuts and she got better completely on her own, or, well, she was never crazy in the first place. 150 years have gone by, and those are the two completely incompatible narratives. And I found in researching this, oh, my God, there's absolutely incontrovertible evidence she was treated by homeopathy, and that's what happened. That story has not been told. And even though the Lincoln saga has been picked over very thoroughly, I'm hoping that that chapter on Mary Todd Lincoln is the Trojan horse for homeopathy as far as finally bringing some truth to the history of medicine in this country around mental health. As I say, I'm a little bit less interested in teaching homeopathy than correcting this problem of censorship. I live in America. This shouldn't be like the Soviet Union, where we pretend because we don't like a particular history or prefer things were a little different, that we just eradicate it. That's really wrong. But I do talk about how she was probably treated. Patterson was very careful about not keeping records. It was known that he used what we call popular medicine of that time, which could only have been homeopathy. And there's no way that she could have gotten that way with moral care treatment, just hand-holding and being treated respectfully. Everybody knew he had a secret weapon, and that secret weapon was homeopathy. And there are many other instances of that at other hospitals, which were not homeopathic necessarily in name, but had famous homeopaths on staff who did these, brought about miraculous effects.
Nice. Well, I really like that you're bringing attention to this. I mean, humanity, by its very nature, I think, deserves choices. The fewer choices we have, the less power we have in our own personal narrative. And when our choices collapse, it affects our future. And so to have a vibrant future is to have a vibrant number of choices. And so I love bringing attention to these successful and powerful healing modalities that have fallen by the wayside, so we can bring back a collage of modalities. I mean, there's how many different modalities are there all over the world, and every culture has their lineage of medicine. And why don't we put it all on the table? And what might not work for one will work for another. And it's blasphemy to collapse things into a narrower and narrower narrative. And so I'm rambling, but I'm so
it's
delighted.
It's complicated
to,
here, because we have the insurance. You know, people think that nothing's legitimate unless it's covered by insurance.
Sure.
Boy, is that a mistake? So this intertwining of the healthcare, the economic model, the reimbursement model with care, so much good stuff is simply not covered, and that unfortunately has the effect of making people think it's not valid. It's a it's a big foolishness. It's unfortunate, but that will take a long time to correct.
Well, now an hour has gone by pretty fast. Now, share with your audience your book, your other books, any resources and modalities that you do. In other words, if you have a practice and you see people, tell people how they can connect with you. And if you could share that with the audience now.
Okay. I'm pretty busy now. It happened for some time, so I'm not necessarily looking for new clients, but I still accept folks, and maybe a few weeks before I get to you. I am frankly more interested in teaching on a larger scale, working less and less with one-to-one, and more with large audiences, like with yours, Les. So I'd like people to be acquainted with my books, which are they're entertaining and they're informative, and people might get some benefit from reading from them. The first book I wrote was called Interpreting Chronic Illness, and that offers a seamless integration of homeopathy, traditional Chinese medicine, and Biomedical Understandings of Chronic Illness. That was a breakthrough book for me, and there's a lot of very good material in there. Second book I wrote, which is a very accessible book called The Toxic Relationship Cure, Remedying Toxic Damage from a Boss, a Lover, a Parent, a Friend, also from God. Some people have bad relationships with spiritual sources. That book is a compilation of fables drawn from my experience. So they're stories which involve the use of remedies to treat these kinds of traumas. Almost everybody can relate to having had some kind of a very traumatic, toxic relationship with someone. A more technical book I wrote after that is called Autism Reversal Toolbox, and that was published by Emrys in Holland. And that's a compilation of strategies that I've learned and case histories in treating in autism and autism spectrum ailments. The fourth book is a lot of fun. It's got a crazy title, and it's written under a pseudonym, called Hamischer Homeopathy, The Schmendrick's Guide to Remedying Yiddish Kvetches. And it's a serious book in disguise, because Yiddish, and I'm not even a native Yiddish speaker, but Yiddish is full of very funny expressions which make great homeopathic rubrics. And so it's a fun way of learning about homeopathy using Jewish jokes and anecdotes and cartoons. So people can look at that. Sane Asylums, The Success of Homeopathy Before Psychiatry Lost Its Mind is, brought out by Inner Traditions. It's available through Simon. It's distributed through Simon & Schuster. If you buy it at the Amazon website, you can write a review of it. And the idea here is really to break through into the mainstream. This is a story that should not have been suppressed. As you say, Les, you know, if this story were told, we would have more choices. The loss of the choices around having homeopathy available, especially in the mental health arena, that's really a sad thing for Americans. It's a lost opportunity. So I want people to become familiar with that book, demand that it be in the libraries, talk about it, get some discussion going, so that we can make some inroads and improve mental health in this country, and not just be driven by profit motive medicine.
Well, very nice. Well, Jerry, I want to thank you for being our guest tonight. I have thoroughly enjoyed this episode.
Thank you so much, Les. You're a wonderful interviewer, and I very much appreciate this opportunity. Keep up the good work. It's so important.
We've been talking with Jerry Cantor, and the topic tonight is the subtitle of his latest book, The Era of Brilliant Homeopathic Mental Hospitals. The name of the book is Sane Asylums. I love Jerry's passion for understanding something and the drive to investigate and learn the power behind it, and then to showcase it. Again, he's written a wonderful book. There's so much material in this book. I think he's really done a service. If we want more freedom in the future, we want more choices in the future. We don't want to collapse our choices into smaller and smaller narratives. That doesn't serve anybody. It's fewer choices, fewer expressions. That's blasphemy to the nature of nature. Nature always expresses itself in ever-evolving ways. It's an expansion of choices, an expansion of expression, an expansion of the creative dynamic of consciousness itself. It doesn't serve us to lose sight of that. Nature always enjoys a broader brush, a broader expression of itself. So we don't want to collapse into narrower and narrower narratives. That doesn't serve us over time. Hey, if you've read my books, Jerry reminded me, Citizen King, the New Age of Power, and Forgiven Sinner, God's Last Savior, I would appreciate it if you go to Amazon and leave a review of my books. And I need to write some more books, damn it. I've been doing this show for so long. I really enjoy such interviewing such a diverse group of guests. Jerry is a classic example of a really sharp and intelligent individual who's given his attention and intention to a topic and really brought forth a very condensed, powerful understanding of yet another way we can serve ourselves. So I want to thank Jerry for being on our show tonight. I want to thank you, the listener. Way to show up for yourself. Humanity, it's impossible for us to exhaust our potential. It is. We could expand our persona every single day for the rest of time, and because we are nature expressing itself, nature's always up for yet another chapter. I want to thank you again for joining us tonight. What a pleasure. Until next time, I'm your host, Les Jensen. Thanks for listening.
This has been a New Human Living Radio broadcast to bring your soul's inspiration into effect and live your life wide open. Check out our host, Les Jensen's book, Citizen King, The New Age of Power, at newhumanliving.com. Thanks for listening.